See if we can get back on schedule here. The next panel, as you know from your program, is From Tet to the American Withdrawal. Since C-SPAN is not here today, I'm going to skip giving the bios of the people. I was doing that yesterday because the vast television audience would not have known who these people were if we hadn't said something about them. But assuming that you all have a copy of the program, you can read who these people are without my going into all of the details. Let me all just say that they're all highly qualified to speak on the subject. Phil Clark is a veteran journalist and commentator. Harry Summers is on the staff of the Strategic Studies Institute of the War College, a colonel, as he sees, and Ken Moorfield, the former national director of the Vietnam Veterans Leadership Program and an Army officer in Vietnam. The order, I guess, will be the order as in the program. We're going to start with Phil Clark.
Thank you, Reed. In a recent $30 million slander suit, Dan Rather brushed off charges he had falsely accused a Los Angeles doctor of insurance fraud with a wisecrack. Quote, "If it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck," said Gunga Dan, "you've got a duck." So it was with NBC after the 1968 Tet Offensive in Vietnam, as revealed by Ames, ever-watchful top watchdog Reed Irvine. A naive young NBC reporter had suggested to producer Robert Northshield that, in light of the facts, maybe the network should correct itself and do a story on how Tet was not a disastrous defeat for the U.S. in South Vietnam, but actually was a disastrous defeat for the communists. "No," said Northshield after a moment's consideration, "the public perceived Tet as a defeat for us, and so it was a defeat," unquote. And so it is, 16 years later, with the PBS's so-called documentary, Vietnam, A History, as it seeks to perpetuate all the old media myths and a few new ones on how we lost the war by backing the wrong side, how Hanoi was the good guy and Saigon was the bad guy, etc., etc., ad nauseum. We've heard from many superb authorities here in the last couple of days on the big picture of the real story. So let me now comment on a few specific examples of distortion in the PBS series, along with a few personal observations during my three assignments in Vietnam in 1970, 72, and 74, that I believe served to rebut or refute at least some of the more blatant disinformation contained in the PBS smear job. In script number 8, called Vietnamizing the War, the narrator tells us, quote, "Chiu stifled democratic opposition," unquote. But just a few seconds before this, the same narrator had said, quote, "In Saigon, demonstrators protested against the Chiu government," unquote. Can we have it both ways? Where was the stifling here? The narrator doesn't explain the contradiction. Actually, as Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker told me in an interview in Saigon in 1970, President Chiu was the most honest and moderate political leader on the South Vietnamese scene at that time. Indeed, there were 16 newspapers in Saigon, many flailing away at the government every day. You could hear complaints openly voiced by almost anyone in South Vietnam, from a Buddhist monk to a taxicab driver to a Saigon GI. And Chiu traveled about the countryside with fewer bodyguards than Jesse Jackson had in San Francisco. And if the democratic opposition needed stifling, how come Chiu's government had armed 1 million or so civilian home guards? If they had wanted to, they could have simply turned their guns around the other way for a few hours and it would have been all over. Again, in script number 8 of the PBS series, the narrator indignantly intones, quote, "Prisoners were held by the Chiu government without trial in hundreds of jails and internment camps throughout South Vietnam," unquote. Well, let's look at the facts. When I led an 8-member fact-finding mission to South Vietnam in early 1974, headed by former Ambassador John Allison, one-time Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs, and Ambassador Elbridge Durbrough, who had served as America's envoy to Saigon from 1957 to 61. Even then, in 1974, there was still a massive propaganda campaign underway accusing the Saigon government and its U.S. advisors of Hitler-like atrocities towards, quote, political prisoners, unquote. Let me quote from our report on political prisoners, fact versus fiction. Following, this is a quote from our report, following recent allegations that the Tew government was holding up to 202,000 political opponents in barbarous captivity, the U.S. Embassy in Saigon undertook what it described as an exhaustive and painstaking analysis utilizing all available sources and covering every penal institution in South Vietnam, from the four national prisons and 35 provincial jails to local police lockups. The embassy survey reached, quote, the firm conclusion that the total prisoner and detention population in South Vietnam in the July-August 1973 period, when the check was conducted, was 35,139. The allegation that the Saigon government harbors 202,000 political prisoners was found to have originated with a well-known government opponent, Father Chan Tin, a Paris-educated redemptorist priest, who, it seems, put the human suffering he encountered among his parishioners in class struggle terms. He also headed an organization he called Committee to Investigate Mistreatment of Political Prisoners, which he defined very broadly to include arrested communist cadre. Well, interestingly, as late as 1974, Father Tin was still putting out his story and continuing to attack the government without interference from the authorities, a fact that would seem to disprove the familiar charge that Saigon jailed all of its opponents. A study group composed of five Vietnam critics who were also briefed on the embassy political prisoner issue recently returned from Saigon, that is, recently after our mission conducted its fact-finding mission, claiming on TV and in press conferences in the States here that, quote, the jails of South Vietnam are full of political prisoners, unquote. Well, that's the way it went. Our fact-finding report delivered at a Washington press conference in 1974 was totally ignored, spiked by the media, and when Ambassador Durbrough and I read our report into the record at a Senate committee hearing, only one senator was on hand, Senator Edward Brooke, and he was busy chatting with a female aide, paying absolutely no attention to our testimony. By contrast, when spokespersons for the five-member anti-war delegation that had followed us around South Vietnam delivered their report to the hearing, Senator Brooke was all ears. So it went in the dark days of 1974 when Watergate dominated the news and South Vietnam was burning and the fiddlers played in Washington, and the 18 million people of South Vietnam who had placed their lives and trust in the U.S. were slowly, inexorably bleeding to death. But as the PBS documentary's narrator informs us, quote, South Vietnam was still spending more on imported cosmetics and beauty aids than it earned from all of its exports, unquote. South Vietnam also was spending a lot of lives, upwards of 40,000 soldiers killed in action in 1972 alone. But no matter, PBS was more interested in playing up the alleged wrongdoings and atrocities on our side. Thus, in transcript number 8, we hear an American woman named Jane Barton, identified only as a civilian aid worker, telling us, quote, when prisoners were tortured, it was by the Americans. In the latter 1960s or in the early 70s, there would be American advisors there, unquote. Shades of El Salvador. The mysterious Ms. Barton follows up with three lengthy segments on the film describing how electric shock devices were used, how a paralyzed old woman was left to die in a bare bed frame spring, unquote, the whole works. Then immediately after Ms. Barton's horror story comes our narrator again with the funniest line of all. Quote, Vietnam was deluged with propaganda, unquote, meaning government propaganda, of course. Well, speaking of propaganda, one of the biggest barefaced lies of the entire Vietnam War had to do with an infamous photo story in Life magazine, July 17, 1970, alleging that the Tew government, with U.S. connivance, was incarcerating thousands of innocent men, women, and children in what were described as tiger cages. on a hellish offshore island called Khon Son. Well, our fact-finding team in 1974 managed to fly over to Khon Son Island for a first-hand look. This is what our report to Congress and the media said. The life story was based on a report by photographer Tom Harkin, a congressional staff aide, and Don Luce, then an executive secretary for the World Council of Churches and a leading peace activist. The story claimed that the so-called tiger cages of Khon Son Island were hidden away in a secret area of the island. Our fact finders found it clearly out in the open behind high white walls and implied that the cells were underground. They were, in fact, above ground, with open grates at the top and with a roof some 15 feet above the cells to protect them from the sun and the rain, and individual doors leading to an open courtyard. The Harkin-Luce story also told of prisoners crouched in their cells. The cells were, in fact, 10 feet from the ceiling to the top grate, and 6 feet 3 inches wide and 10 feet 6 inches deep, far larger than comparable isolation punishment cells in most standard U.S. prisons. The whole thing was built in 1941 by the French during their colonial occupation of Vietnam, and when we visited the area, the families of the guards were using them as living quarters. They were better than the barracks they had to house their own people. So contrary to the life story, which has been endlessly repeated and enlarged upon by anti-Vietnam critics in the years since publication, our group found no evidence, no hard evidence, of systematic mistreatment of prisoners on Khon Son Island. As a matter of fact, Khon Son Island was such an idyllic place physically that I'm sure that if Conrad Hilton could ever catch up with it, it would be one of the finest resorts anywhere in the South China Sea. Beautiful spot. When this correspondent first went to South Vietnam in January 1970, it was because I could not believe what I was reading in the New York Times. In 1972, I still could not believe what I was reading and seeing on the tube. According to the New York Times and the networks, South Vietnam was about to collapse and surrender under the furious North Vietnamese Easter Offensive. The Arvin 5th Division, the so-so outfit with which I had spent most of my assignment in 1970, was reported surrounded and surrendering in a key provincial town called An Lock, northwest of Saigon. If it fell, Saigon also would go. The PBS narrator doesn't mention An Lock, but his voice is full of doom when he describes how, quote, the swift enemy advance left little time for retreat, and, quote, with no American combat troops to support them, the South Vietnamese army seemed to be fighting a losing battle. South Vietnamese troops and their families battled for aircraft space to flee the enemy, unquote. Yet, from all I could gather, An Lock continued to hold out. So I went back to South Vietnam to get the story of the incredible siege of An Lock. I first offered to do the story for the New York Times. I got a letter from some editorial assistant rejecting my proposal and suggesting sarcastically that, quote, no one would even remember An Lock in a few weeks, unquote. Or as he inferred, give a damn. I did get the Reader's Digest to publish my story a year later, and ironically, it was entitled The Battle That Saved Saigon. With your indulgence, I'd like to read just a couple of excerpts from that story so you can judge yourself whether the story of An Lock deserved telling or whether the New York Times and the PBS were right to ignore it. For 3 terrible months, this is quote now, besieged An Lock came under one of the most devastating artillery bombardments in history. More than 78,000 rounds of rocket, mortar, and high-explosive artillery shells rained down onto an area less than 1 mile square. For the North Vietnamese, it was a war of attrition. For the South Vietnamese and their dozen American advisors, it was a desperate, never-ending struggle for survival. With all of An Lock under bombardment, the order of the day was dig. For hundreds of homeless civilians, however, there was simply no place to hide. Unable to find room in the tightly thronged shelters, about 2,000 men, women, and children crowded into St. Joseph's Catholic Church, its bullet-riddled wooden spire rising above the western part of town. During a noon prayer service, an enemy shell crashed through the roof and exploded near the altar. 40 persons, including a priest, were killed. Another 200 or more wounded. As survivors ran screaming from the carnage, 3 more bursts hit the churchyard, claiming still more victims. By late April, An Lock was being pounded by more than 2,000 rounds a day. Armored probes were biting deeper and deeper into the tiny perimeter. Lieutenant Colonel Edward Benedict of Union, New Jersey, an advisor to the 7th Regiment, said, quote, "The enemy pounded and pounded and pounded. He'd hit and take a house, then reinforce at night, and next day take the next house and the next. And when you're working in only 1,000 square meters, you can lose only so many houses," unquote. At first, said Benedict, some of the Arvins broke and ran, but there was nowhere to go, so they'd pull together after a couple of blocks and hold. The enemy would come at them first with a barrage and a battalion. We'd wipe it out, but the enemy would return with another battalion or company or platoon until he finally had a row of houses and a block and two blocks. By May 1st, nearly half of Anlach's defenders had been killed or wounded. Only about 3,500 effectives remained. With Anlach enveloped in enemy fire, barely a handful of reinforcements had got through. More than 1,000 wounded awaited evacuation. The last remaining vehicle, a badly shot-up jeep, was running on its rims in borrowed time. Anlach's artillery battery was down to just one gun. Sanitation problem was critical. Most of the community wells had been destroyed by gunfire, contaminated by bodies. Civilians killed fetching water were buried where they fell. Dysentery and malaria were rampant. 3 women had died of cholera. There had been several bursts, but in the fetid, overcrowded shelters, few infants survived. Some of the Montagnard children, who had known only the outdoor wilderness, suffocated in the foul confines, their passing scarcely noticed but for a mother's weeping. Shallow graves hurriedly dug and seldom marked lined the streets and pathways and dotted the schoolyard and rubble-strewn park. Many bodies had to be reburied after exploding shells destroyed the graves. Near the helicopter landing zone, a choice enemy target, an instant cemetery had sprung up where many wounded soldiers died or were killed before they could be airlifted out. Some had crawled to the LZ trailing blood, their cries unheard or unavailing amid the thunder of battle. A few in despair committed suicide. Blood plasma and other medical supplies were airdropped regularly. Many of the chutes fell outside the perimeter. Saigon parachuted syringes so Anlach could draw its own blood. Anlach's hospital compound, overflowing with dead and injured, was shelled repeatedly, its Red Cross markings all but obliterated by enemy shrapnel. Captain Li Huxi, one of the 2 Arvin doctors who remained alive, was at the hospital when a shell blew up the morgue, hurling the corpses into the air. Under the constant rain of shells, only death owned the streets. One American advisor put the odds for surviving 5 minutes in the open at 50-50. Even a trip to the latrine was a carefully planned and executed operation, a calculated risk, one of the survivors told me. 3 weeks after the start of the siege, Anlach had absorbed more than 20,000 rounds of artillery fire. Bomb craters pockmarked the enemy terrain. From 3,000 feet, said one veteran U.S. airman, it had the look of Berlin in 1945, all gray and black and lifeless. As the enemy's relentless shelling mounted to more than 4,000 rounds a day, discipline and morale began breaking down. Fighting his way to the Arvin command bunker, Major Kenneth Ingram, 34-year-old Army veteran from Nitro, West Virginia, got another shock. Everyone had a look of death, he told me, as though waiting for their own funeral. Bad as it was for the soldiers, the civilians had it worse. Early in May, the enemy began firing shells with delayed fuses that exploded 6 feet in the ground. At one night alone, more than 500 men, women, and children were killed or injured. One night alone. Colonel Walter F. Ulmer, Jr., who replaced Colonel Miller as senior U.S. advisor on May 11th, inspected some of the civilian shelters. Never had I imagined such misery. Children, women, old people were jammed together in holes in the ground. There was barely enough food to stay alive. They were frightened and covered with dirt and grime. Some were bleeding and dying. It had to be close to the maximum humans could endure, unquote. A large part of the Americans' job was to inspire confidence. It wasn't easy, Ulmer told me. We knew the soldiers and civilians were watching us for the slightest sign of despair. So we had to keep up a good front, even when it was too painful just to think about home, unquote. In northernmost South Vietnam, Arvin's Greenest Division, the 3rd, panicked and ran. The ancient imperial capital of Hue was in imminent peril, its streets filled with rioting soldiers. In the central highlands, armored enemy forces threatened to cut South Vietnam in half. And the headline in one of the New York newspapers, I give you one guess as to which one, said, "Vietnamization has failed a key test," unquote. For Anlach's survivors, death was becoming a way of life, accepted casually. Midnight on May 10th, enemy guns began blasting Anlach's perimeter with the heaviest bombardment of all, 8,300 rounds of high explosive in 10 hours, or nearly one every 4 seconds. It was like an earthquake, Major Ingram told me. The bunker trembled and moved in the ground. All I could do was sit there and recite to myself the Lord's Prayer and the 23rd Psalm. As prophesied, the enemy had destroyed Anlach, but not its people. At 0530 hours, the awesome barrage suddenly lifted. The tanks rolled in, 40 to 50 of them from 360 degrees. This time, the defenders were ready and eager. Scrambling from their foxholes, bunkers, tank killer teams opened up with Laws, light anti-tank weapons at close range. Near the command bunker, Anlach's battered howitzer took on a T-54. The artillery chief was killed. The crew kept firing until the tank was hit and blown up. And in mid-morning, the skies cleared and swarms of Allied fighter bombers and gunships stacked a dozen deep, skillfully guided by relays of FAC pilots, dropping white phosphorus smoke bombs darted through curtains of flak to rocket and strafe the enemy from rooftop level. 297 tactical missions flown in that one day. As the enemy infantry got set to attack, B-52s struck from bases in Thailand. For 24 solid hours, the eight-engine jets roared high over Anlach. One flight of three planes every 55 minutes. With unerring precision, they dropped more than 3,000 tons of 750-pound bombs, pulverizing the North Vietnamese positions in as close as 800 meters from the defense perimeter. Crouched in their bunkers, the defenders alertly prayed that the bombs could hit where they were supposed to and cheered when they did. When it was all over, an NVA regimental officer and 10 men staggered dazedly from the smoking ruins and surrendered. Hundreds of others had died. More than 1,000 were wounded. The back of the enemy attack had been broken. I'm paraphrasing now. The shelling continued for a month, but it was in lessening intensity. And at the entrance to Colonel Nutt, N-U-H-T, he was the provincial chief, a schoolgirl's inscription was tacked up. It read, "Anlach, the territory of history, salutes its heroes. They died for their country," unquote. On July 12th, the Sea of Humanity, more than 10,000 civilians began an exodus south along Highway 13 toward government refugee camps. On June 4th, the Arvin 6th Airborne Battalion was airlifted 4 miles south of Anlach. 1750 hours, June the 8th, the relief column entered Anlach amid wild rejoicing. The siege was over. Intelligence estimated the enemy dead at 10,000. It's wounded at more than 15,000. The NVA's once powerful 5th Division retreated to Parrot's Beak, some regiments with fewer than 100 men. Anlach's defenders had lost nearly 5,000 dead or wounded. The 7th Regiment had counted 333 survivors out of 1,200. And one rough pup platoon of 18, only three survived. The civilian toll never would be known with certainty. There was no one to do the counting. But the dead or wounded exceeded 5,000. Miraculously, none of the 25 U.S. advisors in Anlach was a casualty, but 10 were killed or missing in action outside the town. There was yet another final act of irony. On January 26, 1973, Colonel William P. Nolde of Grand Rapids, Michigan, was killed by a communist artillery shell just 11 hours before the Vietnam ceasefire. He was the 46,752nd and last American killed in action in the Vietnam War. The place, Anlach. And the fatal round had come from a captured American 105 on Hill 169 overlooking Anlach. Well, was it worth it? The epic siege had bought South Vietnam another 3 years of precious freedom. It also helped bring Hanoi to the negotiating table so the last of our GIs could safely be withdrawn. Most of all, Anlach, a microcosm of the Vietnam conflict itself, answered those critics who accused our servicemen of dogging it and our Arvin allies of running away. Thus the story of Anlach, unmentioned by the PBS in its 13-hour documentary, ignored by most of our mass media, too busy depicting our side as cowardly or worse. Many other examples of media bias come to mind, which other members of the panel will undoubtedly discuss. Script number 10, for example, used enemy statistics regarding the Christmas bombing of 72-73. North Vietnamese survivor accounts are played up about the horrors of the American carpet bombing without any factual rebuttal whatsoever. Script number 12, called The End of the Tunnel, quotes at length from Frank Snepp, the disgruntled Sour Grapes ex-CIA agent, who tells of the burial of the last, and it also tells of the burial of the last American to die in South Vietnam, Colonel Nolde, in Arlington, but again, no mention of where he died, Anlach. And concludes with a narrator saying, America had suffered its first defeat in Vietnam. No, I would rather suggest that it was not a defeat. It was an abandonment. An abandonment thanks to the biased media of this country. The rest was history. The Arvin virtually ran out, literally ran out of ammunition at the end. It fought as best it could. The U.S. Congress had pulled the plug. South Vietnam was to go down the drain. As for the media, As a veteran journalist of 41 years in this business, I hang my head in shame for what my profession did to confuse and manipulate and mislead the American people. Now, as a member of AIM's Speakers Bureau, I'm proud to be not only a journalist, but an American, working with others here to see that, hopefully, the truth shall prevail. Thank you very much.
Hard act to follow, but I want to talk to you in two dimensions this morning. One dimension is an active duty Army colonel on the faculty of the Army War College who teaches a course on Vietnam War strategy and the author of a book that I mentioned earlier on strategy, a critical analysis of the Vietnam War. And following those remarks, I'd like to talk to you for a few moments as a citizen, as a Vietnam veteran, from a slightly different perspective. It was interesting, very interesting, the comments on Ann Locke. A good friend of mine, we were lieutenants together, Burr Willie, was killed on Route 13 on that very siege. And one of the aftermaths, if you will, of Ann Locke, on the cover of Newsweek magazine, the July 9th edition, you may have seen the picture of now Lieutenant General Walt Ulmer, who took part in that siege and is now commanding our 3rd Corps at Fort Hood, Texas, and I think a very well-done write-up on the state of the military today. Part of the problem of putting Vietnam in perspective is a sense of we have to go back to theory, and Mr. Hong yesterday, I thought, did us a great service on looking at the philosophical way of looking at the problems that we face. Unfortunately, to most Americans, including the students at the Army War College, if you say philosophy, their eyes glaze over. We're really not a philosophical people. We're not interested in philosophy. We tend to be action-oriented, to get on with the problem and not look at the roots of it. But one of the things I try to do in my book is to go back and look at military theory and to see how military theory explains, at least, what happened in Vietnam. And one of the sources of military history, probably the best source on military theory, is a book written 150 years ago by Carl von Clausewitz called On War, which lays out the theoretical foundations of the art of war, if you will. One of the things he talks about that we haven't thought very much about is what he calls the concept of polarity. And he reminds us that polarity doesn't depend on whether one side is on the attack and the other side is on the defense, that polarity has to do with the objectives of both sides. And this was first brought home to us by General Douglas MacArthur in his testimony before the Congress in 1951, when he pointed out to the Senate that his mission was to resist aggression, but the mission of the North Koreans and Chinese was to destroy the U.S. and South Korean armies and the total conquest of South Korea. So we had a fundamental difference in the objectives in that war between the objectives of the enemy and the objective of our side and the side of our allies. We have the same problem in Vietnam. The North Vietnamese, and someone quoted P.J. Honey yesterday, P.J. Honey, 10 years before we got involved in Vietnam, pointed out that the North Vietnamese had said very clearly that their objective was the total control of Indochina. They made no bones about that. Their objective was the total conquest of the South and, as a matter of fact, the total conquest of Indochina. Our objective, as Admiral Moore pointed out so well yesterday in the luncheon speech, our objective, again, was to resist aggression. So that we had a fundamental difference in the objectives of both sides. And that difference really complicated the course of the war. I would argue that given those differences, that the best that the military can do is to stalemate the battlefield situation, as we did in the Korean War, and the decision then has to be done by other means, primarily by diplomatic or political means. But we didn't really see the theoretical foundations of what we were involved in. Now, if you take this same analysis and apply it to the media, you again run up against the same problem. We are confronted with an adversary whose media is an instrument of the state and whose objective of that media is to enhance the power of the state. where on our side we have a media who are an instrument of the people, and ideally, whose objective is to keep the state honest. So you have a fundamental difference in the objectives of the media between ourselves and our adversaries. And what worries me as a professional military officer is that given this imbalance on this, if you will, the psychological dimension of power, is an area that the military is powerless to do anything about. Thank God that in our country the military is powerless to do it. We have some countries in the world where the military take it upon themselves to correct that imbalance. Also, our political leadership is powerless to do anything about it, lest they jeopardize the very freedoms that they are created to enhance. The only people who can deal with this imbalance between the media of a totalitarian society and the media of an open society is the media. They are our front line of defense. Only they can expose enemy propaganda as enemy propaganda. Only they can make it clear this imbalance that exists. I wrote a review of Karnow's book that was published in the front page of Book World in the Washington Post and said that given the genre of Vietnam literature, that Karnow's book was one of the more balanced books to come out of the Vietnam War, although it had its faults. But I ended up the review by saying, and this was before the PBS series began, that unfortunately, I was afraid the conclusion was going to be love the book, hated the movie. And that was only too true. And I said the reason why I felt that way was that the footage just isn't there. One of our speakers yesterday talked about, I believe it was Professor Loeb, talked about the problems of television as an instrument of history. What you have on our side is free and open reporting covering every spectrum of the war, and on their side, you have the Reichstalian footage of propaganda films provided by their government. And that, unfortunately, is the footage that's available. When these teams went to Hanoi, the only people they were allowed to interview are the people the government allowed them to interview. They were dealing with a state-controlled media who, as I said, exist for the promotion of state power. So you get a fundamental inherent imbalance in coverage one side to the other. And that, I think, came through only too clearly in the presentation of the PBS series. But the point, I think, that's necessary to be made, that is inherent in the nature of any type of documentary between a free society on one hand and a totalitarian society on the other. De Tocqueville, 100 and some years ago, warned us of the problems of a confrontation between a totalitarian, that time a monarchy, and a free society, and it's something that's endemic. So that I must say I'm very pleased to see that AIM, in its AIM's attempts to write this, to demand these defenses, if you will, to protect us against this kind of psychological warfare, because the military can't do it for us. I think, having said that, however, we need to be very careful and not fall into the same trap that we accuse the other side of doing. Because of the publication of the book and because of renewed interest in military matters, I've had occasion to be interviewed several times by the media in the past several years, and I find out that it's wrong, you know, it's worse than a crime, it's a folly, to totally condemn the media out of hand. When I was interviewed by the military correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, for example, Brad Knickerbocker, I find out that Brad was an F-4 pilot in the Coral Sea during the Vietnam War. He certainly is not an opponent of the military. When I was interviewed by Richard Halloran of the New York Times, their military correspondent for the Times, I find out that he's the son and grandson of military academy graduates who enlisted in the Army as an enlisted man, went through OCS at Fort Benning, and served a tour as an infantry officer in the Army, so that he is not, per se, an enemy of the military. You'd be surprised to find out the number of Vietnam veterans, for example, now, who are in very influential positions. I was interviewed on National Public Radio's All Things Considered and found out that the producer of the show was a Spec 4 in Vietnam. It's interesting to note that Donald Graham was also a Spec 4 in Vietnam. Howard K. Smith's name came up last night and mentioned Jack Smith, his son, who was very badly wounded as a rifleman in the 7th Cav of the 1st Cav Division. But I did note that it wasn't mentioned that Jack Smith is now a correspondent for ABC News and appears nightly on the ABC News program. Bill Malden's son was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. So the point I'm trying to make is that there are many friends in the media. There are many people who understand these problems. And to condemn all of them out of hand is to do ourselves a major disservice. I think we have to be very selective and encourage those people who are doing the right things and protest those ones who are not. I did a piece for the Atlantic magazine and unfortunately wasn't published, but in the course of it, I went back and reviewed a book on William Howard Russell, the first military correspondent who sent his dispatches from the Crimea during the Crimean War. And his dispatches were so powerful that they brought down the British government at the time. But it was interesting to read in a book written, by the way, 50 years ago, so it's not tainted by any of our current controversies, that the officers in the field said that Russell's dispatches were essentially correct. However, the editor of the Times had his own agenda, and his agenda was to bring down the government. So he very selectively used the dispatches that came out of the war in order to bring down the British government. And I read this with a sense of deja vu, because if any of you, and certainly some of you in the media know this much better than I do, that the working reporter's dispatches from the field, he has very little control over what ultimately gets in print. And I think we heard that over the last few days about dispatches that were sent and were edited by the editors sitting back in the United States, not familiar with the conditions, who had their own particular political agenda. I think another factor of this, let me speak not so much as an instructor at the War College, but as a Vietnam veteran, as a citizen. I think as we look at this PBS series, and as we examine it, there's one factor of it that we've not given sufficient attention to. I've been fortunate enough, and you'll hear later about the activities of what I think is a very remarkable group, the Vietnam Veterans Leadership Program, that attempts to enlist the overwhelming majority of Vietnam veterans who have come back to the United States, are proud of their service, who have gone out in civilian life and made their mark in civilian life. These are non-people because these are not the Vietnam veterans that are normally portrayed. But they will be. They will be as these Vietnam veterans get into positions of authority. My feeling is that time is on their side. And I think the whole attitude of the American people toward the Vietnam War is undergoing a change. I said much earlier that if you're going to be a revisionist on the Vietnam War, and most academics would like to be revisionists because that's the way you make your name and your reputation, the only way you can be a revisionist on Vietnam is to be pro-Vietnam, because everything anti-Vietnam has been said 10 times over. So I think the Karnow book, in a sense, is an indication of that. That is, there's a remarkable amount of balance in there. For example, he, in his book, and I quoted this in the Washington Post Review, points out the fallacy of the so-called carpet bombing of Hanoi during the Christmas bombing. And also, in his book, points out that a group of anti-war activists tried to get the mayor of Hanoi to claim 10,000 casualties for the account, but the mayor of Hanoi, saying that he wanted to be honest, is remarkable, said that there was only, 1,300 casualties or whatever it was. And Karnow goes on to point out that true carpet bombing, that is, the carpet bombing in Berlin, for example, or Tokyo, where you have somewhat like 100,000 killed in one night's bombing, that if there had been true carpet bombing, Hanoi would no longer exist. So that's in the book. It's not in the documentary. So there's some, he also pointed out, I thought very relevant toward military strategy, that at the height of the Vietnam War, we were trying to devise a military strategy. The Assistant Secretary of Defense convenes a panel of Harvard scholars to come up with a military strategy for the Vietnam War. If you want one vignette that tells you what went wrong in Vietnam, that seems to me a pretty good one to tell us what happened. Can you imagine George Marshall allowing a group of academics in 1942 coming up with a military strategy for the war? He'd have resigned on the spot. But one of the things that we, in retrospect, that it's hard to see is that this country, the political leadership, and unfortunately, in my thesis, the senior military leadership, wasn't aware we were in a war until we'd lost it. We thought we were in a pacification program. We thought we were in a counterinsurgency program. And what was happening on the battlefield was not being translated back at the national level. You read a book, How Much is Enough, by Inhofe and Smith, which is sort of the Bible of the Pentagon in 1966, a 200-page book, 20 pages of which are devoted to Vietnam. And that was probably about right. About 10% of the attention at the highest levels was being paid to the war in Vietnam. it's hard to realize now that this was a back burner affair for a long time, until suddenly it boiled over the entire stove. It's illustrative to look at Great Britain, it seems to me, in the Falklands campaign versus the United States and Vietnam. As soon as the war started in the Falklands, the first thing Margaret Thatcher did was form a war cabinet. She knew that Great Britain was at war, and the entire prestige of the nation was on the line, even though the war itself was a very minor affair in the Falklands. And you look at the chain of command and the chain of authority that was given and the operational instructions that were given to the commander of the British fleet, and compare that with a convoluted bureaucratic nightmare that we had to endure during the Vietnam War. And you see that we have major problems. One, there wasn't an awareness that when the United States goes to war, the entire prestige of the United States is on the line. We found that out, even though it may be a very small affair halfway around the world. And that's a hard point to get across. What we had, and I think one of the better definitions of our problems in Vietnam, was business as usual. That we never made the transition from peace to war that was necessary to get our act together. I did a piece for the American Heritage this year in the February edition on the Battle of the Yidrong, the first major battle of the Vietnam War, a meeting engagement between the 1st Cavalry Division and the North Vietnamese Division's regiments in the Valley of the Yidrong in 65. And as I got into it, I found, ironically, that in two of our last three wars, we'd lost the first battle. We certainly lost the first battle of World War II in Bataan and Corregidor, and also in the plains of North Africa. And we lost the first battle of the Korean War, which I unfortunately had a part in as a corporal, had a real major key role. But we lost the first battle of the Korean War, certainly at Tejon, and almost lost it at the Pusan perimeter. But in the Vietnam War, we won the first battle. But what happened to us by losing the first battle of World War II in Korea, it's that great line of Samuel Johnson's, you know, nothing so concentrates your mind as the knowledge you're going to be hanged in a fortnight. Well, we had the idea if we didn't get our act together, if we didn't get serious about it, we could lose it. We never had that feeling in Vietnam. We didn't really. One of the tragedies is in talking to some of the very senior people of the war, General Westmoreland, the late Harold K. Johnson, then Chief of Staff of the Army, was the feeling that, well, we knew better, and we had recommended better ways to do it, but it really didn't matter, because no matter what we did, we'd prevail. And what we ignored was the first fundamental of war. As Clausewitz told us 150 years ago, war is an exercise of will to compel the other side to do your bidding. It all rests on will. So one of the tragic failures of the Vietnam War was the deliberate decision by the administration not to mobilize the American will in support of the war. That was a deliberate act because the feeling was it would jeopardize the Great Society programs, and besides, this was such a small affair anyway, it wasn't really necessary. And then allied with that, the idea that you could exclude the American people from the strategic equation. Well, the American people ultimately had something to say about that. As Thomas Jefferson or James Madison or Alexander Hamilton could have told them, since they wrote it into the Constitution and discussed it in the Federalist Papers back in 1789. It was hardly a new lesson. We talked about the price of the Vietnam War. What we forget is that price and price of anything only has meaning in relationship to value. And the reason why you need to mobilize the American people is to concentrate the value of what you're trying to do. The value in World War II was preservation of the nation. The sacrifices or the price we were willing to pay for that were enormous, over 1 million casualties. We're still arguing to this day over what the value was of our commitment to Vietnam. So it shouldn't have surprised us that there was immediate concern about the price that was being paid. So the first requirement to take this nation to war, as James Madison told us in 1789, is to convince the American people that the value of what they're trying to do. I have two sons that are captains in the Army. I certainly want to know the value of what they're going to be doing if they're committed to battle. So the idea that you can just assume away the people who have to pay for a war in terms of the lives of their sons and daughters and their tax money is ridiculous. And I think that this is a lesson, by the way, that seems to have been learned, because I think we see now an attempt by the administration to build a consensus and to build a rationale for what we're trying to do.